Session 1.
Sanshi Bhagi Jushimeta Jam Vira Vinci Nyende Yampadi Sanghe Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogunanda Shimba Sanghe Chodan Sanghe Chodama Chanchu Badu Dagni Kasuchi Dagi Chunyen Dibe Sanangi Dora Penche Sanghe Chubasho Sanghe Chodan Sanghe Chodama Chanchu Vadu Dami Kasushi Dagi Chumyen Dipe Sanangi Jola Penche Sanghe Jupasho Sanghe Chodan Sanghe Chodama Chanchu Vadu Dami Suchi Dahi Chunyen Gibe Sanangi Yola Penche Sange Juhasho.
Okay, so we'll start. My name is Michael Roach. I studied in a Mongolian monastery in New Jersey for about 10 years. And with a very great lama named Geshe Losan Tarchin, and then studied in India in a monastery for about 10 more years. And sometimes I feel silly when I come to give a talk because the people who are already here are I think more qualified to talk than I am, but I guess variety is good. I heard a lot about your center, the Kadampa Center, and I've heard a lot about Don Brown. And I've never been here before, but it's nice to be here. And we were talking about the meaning of Kadampa, and Kadampas were these, they were like the early Christians. They were the first practicing Buddhists in Tibet, and they were, you know, Tibet didn't have Buddhism, and they were just people like you and I who started studying with these lamas who showed up from India, and they were very fanatical. It was very interesting because they didn't know anything, so they had to learn everything from scratch. There weren't many books in Tibetan, and people would go to India and come back with one part of the Buddhist teachings, and then other ones would go and get something else. And if you try to draw the lineage tree, I tried it one time, you know, who taught who what, it looks like a tumbleweed, because you know, everyone was teaching everybody else what they knew. So you had friends teaching each other. One would go to India and learn Abhidharma, and another one would go to India and learn a middle way, and then they would come and teach each other. They also asked people to teach, come and teach, who, you know, who, I mean, they really want the teaching to spread, and they're not thinking, you know, oh, this guy's just an American, and I don't, you know, to ask me to come and teach is also a great, it's a good, it shows the goodness of their own hearts, you know. So you should appreciate it, and you should appreciate Lama Sopa and Lama Yeshe, who started the whole thing. So you're very lucky, and there's not many centers like this in this country. So it may seem like a small group of your friends, but it's a very great thing. It's a very holy thing, and you're very lucky to have it. Kadampa is a beautiful word. It means Kadampa Sharwa. When I teach, I like to force people to say some Tibetans. So say ka dambar sharwa. Ka dambar sharwa. I say even if you never want to learn Tibetan, you should hear some Tibetan and say some Tibetan, and then sooner or later you, all the people who said they would never learn it end up learning it. We have in New York about 50 people learning it who said, you know, most of them are cab drivers or things like that, and they swore they would never learn Tibetan. And now some of them are teaching Tibetan. That's nice. Kadampa Sharwa means, Ka means the word of the Buddha. It also means the command of a king. So the Ka is the actual speech of an enlightened being. For example, the word Kangyur, the Ka there means the speech of the Buddha, and Gyur means translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan. So the name for our canon is the Kangyur. Dhamma Sharwa means, personal advice. Like if a Lama takes you into a room and gives you some advice, heart-to-heart advice, that's Dhamma. There's many kinds of instruction. Like a tree is when a Lama gets up and gives an explanation of a text, and a Wong is where a Lama gets up and gives an initiation. But a Dhamma is something where he pulls you in a room and he says something to you, personal, heart-to-heart, something that's meant just for you. Sometimes it's called shelshe, which means to know something from the Lama's mouth. So this is where the Lama is giving you a heart-to-heart instruction, and that's what Dhamma means. Sharwa means it comes up in your mind, that word, that way. It's the word that means the dawn of the sun. It's the word that means for something to light up in your mind like an electric light bulb, right? And for example, the word for east is shar, because that's where the sun lights up first in the morning. So Kadampa Sharwa means that you reach a point in your personal practice, in your own practice, where even if you take a tiny scrap of Buddhist text, let's say someone has ripped up a text and thrown it on the ground, and you take up one of those scraps and there's like five words on it, that will immediately sharwa as Dhamma. That Ka will sharwa as Dhamma in your mind. It means that you'll immediately understand it as something that the Buddha meant for you to pick up and read those five words and suddenly understand them and know what it means. So Kadampas had reached this level where no matter what teaching they heard, or no matter what, they were so sincere and they were meditating so well that no matter what little scrap of teaching they heard, it immediately seemed like the Buddha was talking to them personally. And that's what Kadampa means. So the Kadampas were just really pure meditators and practitioners, and they had reached a point where no matter what teaching they heard, it was exactly the right teaching for them at that moment. And that's a Kadampa. So you try to be a Kadampa. I mean, it takes a lot of goodness to be a Kadampa. Because you only get that reaction when you've been studying for a while, and you've been sincere, and you're meditating. So I think you're Kadampas in that way. And then I think you're Kadampas in the sense of you are the pioneers of Buddhism in America. We are the first generation. It's very exciting, and it's also a big responsibility. You have to learn things very well, and you have to be able to pass them on to other people. The older lamas who came to this country, have many of them have passed away, and now it's come down to our generation where we have to. You know, you're not only listening to a teaching for your own benefit, but you, by listening, you then have a responsibility to store it and keep it and pass it on to the next generation. So, as you listen, try to keep that in mind. So you're Kadampas in all of those senses, and should be, okay? I'm going to talk for about an hour. I don't think it's, personally, I can't keep my attention for more than an hour usually when I'm in a class, especially in the afternoon on a warm day after lunch. So I like to stop after maybe an hour and a half, and we'll take a break and have some, you have some coffee and tea and what are those drugs that keep people awake? So we'll do that. So I don't like to go on much longer than that. And then we'll come back and do some more. What I wanted to talk about, you know, the talk was advertised as the marriage of karma and emptiness. And it's meant to indicate that there's a close relationship between karma and emptiness. And so I want to talk about that in general, and then we'll get in. Today we're going to do we're going to talk about karma. What is karma? Now hopefully by tomorrow we'll get into emptiness, and by late tomorrow they'll get married or something. So I think when I was first starting to study, you know, like you, I heard about emptiness, and I had all these weird ideas about it. I think, like anyone would, and I, especially, and that's how this talk came up. Don said, "Can you think of anything that relates, like, emptiness to your real life? You know, what's emptiness got to do with your real life?" And I used to wonder about that myself. I used to think, okay, emptiness sounds neat. You know, it's something that you might happen to you in meditation. And it's some kind of deep black hole somewhere. And if you perceive it, something weird would happen during your meditation. And I used to sit and meditate and wait for it to come, you know. and then, you know, the question of how would it possibly change me, or how would it affect my daily life, you know, what good is emptiness to my daily life? You know, I used to be very confused about that, and I used to constantly wonder, okay, so what's emptiness got to do with me? You know, so what happens if I see emptiness, or so what if everything's empty? You know, it doesn't seem to change anything. I don't see how it would help if I was at the dentist's office and he was drilling my tooth and he hit a nerve, you know, and then suddenly I could think about emptiness. Would it change anything? You know, would anything change? Or what's emptiness got to do with, if I go to work and, you know, I work during the day and I work in a normal office and people are always yelling at me, or people are having fights, or the company's in financial problems, and, you know, all the normal things that happen. And I just couldn't see how emptiness would have anything to do with my life. You know, I couldn't see, and then there were all these weird explanations of emptiness. You know, some people would say, the worst ones, and now I'm going through a bad list, okay, so don't think this is the correct ones. I think the worst one of all time, I read in a book by there was a lady who described this, that she went to a hotel for a Buddhism conference, and there was people there, and on the last day they were all checking out, and one lady's suitcase fell down on the floor and it broke open, and all the hotel's towels came out of the suitcase. And here's this Buddhist lady, you know, and she's sort of embarrassed, and she says, well, it's okay, everything's empty anyway, you know. And I think that's the worst all-time explanation. And you, as Americans get more sophisticated about Dharma, we don't fall for that anymore. But I think in the early days, they would say, oh, I can, because things are empty, I can do what I want. Or because things are empty, samsara, meaning the suffering of this life, and nirvana, meaning the freedom from much of that suffering, are, they're the same thing, you know. They're empty, so they're the same thing. You know, it's the same thing whether I just stay suffering or achieve nirvana, because they're both empty, you know. So, or because things are empty, you know, I don't have to be moral. The teachings on morality, which are the first 16 volumes of the canon, 16,000 pages on how to live an ethical life. Once you get to volume 17 about emptiness, you don't need those 16, you know. If you can get advanced enough understanding emptiness, you know, all that other stuff is just sort of passé. And if you really understood emptiness, you wouldn't need all that monk's vow stuff and all that bodhisattva vow stuff, because you'd be beyond everything. If you understood emptiness, it wouldn't matter anymore. So that was like, that was a pretty popular thing. I remember we translated a book by Nagarjuna and we submitted it to a publisher, and they said, could you tone down the morality and tune up the emptiness, you know? And they wanted us to take out the ethical living part because it wasn't very interesting, you know? And I think that's one typical wrong idea. And I just think, that when you, that emptiness is something that you perceive in a deep state of meditation, and then it's not very relevant to the rest of your life, and especially not relevant to any kind of ethical way of life. So I think those are some serious misperceptions. I think a little more subtle is, if I saw emptiness today, you know, how would I change? Would I, for example, would I still hurt? You know, would I still have suffering? You know, this somehow understanding emptiness, does that change your ability to deal with suffering? You know, do you still feel the dentist drill or not? You know, what's the use of seeing emptiness? You know, if it doesn't change that, then why bother with it? You know, and if it does change that, then is it true that you can take any lama and start drilling on his teeth and he won't jump, you know? I mean, so what's emptiness got to do with stopping suffering or old age, for example? You know, say ke, ke, louder, you guys, it's louder. Ke, ga, na, shi, ke, ga, na, shi. Ke means being born, ga means getting old, na means getting sick, and shi means dying. Those are the four great sufferings, you know. So what use is perceiving emptiness for those four things, you know? Does seeing emptiness just make me a better person, or make me a nicer person, or make me better able to put up with the, excuse me, crap of this life, okay? I mean, is that its purpose? Is it just supposed to make me more patient with the suffering, or more able to withstand a lousy life? Or is it more profound? You know, is it really supposed to get me out of aging? Is it supposed to stop my aging? You know, is it supposed to stop my dying? You know, and how come it's not working? You know, these lamas die, and the Dalai Lama is getting bald. He jokes about it. You know, me too. And you know, if it doesn't stop that, because that's what Buddhism is supposed to be about. You know, is Buddhism supposed to just make me a nice person until I die? Or is it supposed to make me very, very patient with all the sufferings that come to me in life? You know, is that the idea of Buddhism? Am I just supposed to become some super patient person who can put up with any kind of suffering and still be happy, you know? Or is it actually meant to remove those sufferings, you know, completely? And if it is, then how come all these big lamas are still suffering, you know? I mean, it's a question, you know, and that's a... What is the purpose of seeing emptiness? You know, what's the goal? Is it just supposed to make me a little happier while I suffer? Or is it actually something very radically meant to remove that suffering entirely? And if so, well, how does it work? You know, so I think that's what we want to talk about today. And those are the subjects we're going to talk about. My approach is, I grew up as a Tsenyipa. My Lama, incredibly kind Lama, taught me for 22 years so far. He's a Tsenyipa. Tsenyipa means a logician. I mean, we do debating and we study through logic very heavily. Then there's a Lam Rimba where you study more the Lam Rim teachings and you learn the experientially what to do. So we have to talk about emptiness from the point of view of figuring it out intellectually, and then we have to talk about it from the point of view of what actually happens to you, which are two different things. You know, it's one thing to understand emptiness as a Tsenyipa, as a logician, and it's another thing to undergo the experience of seeing emptiness directly. So, you know, I grew up in a different tradition than most Buddhists in America, and in that I was trained by a Lama who's a Tsenyipa, and he has to have everything proved logically. So that's, you know, for some people it's boring, but that's the way I can do it. You know, that's the way I can cover it with you. So I'm going to be quoting a lot from the original books of Buddhism. We study in the monastery five great books. These are all the different great schools of ancient India. And they're the five great subjects of ancient Indian Buddhism. Then in all the monasteries in Tibet and in India, they studied those five books. And then Tsongkhapa came along in the 1400s, and he unified all those five books into a manual for practice, and that was the Lamrim. The Lamrim started before that, but it was Tsongkhapa and Pabongka Rinpoche who had this talent for taking the knowledge of those five books and then making it accessible to normal people in the Lamrim. So we're going to go straight to the five books, and that's the way I like to do it. So nothing I'm going to say is my own idea. You were just going to do sections from the original text, and that's the way I like to do it. So you have to start out with a book called Abhidharma. Abhidharma was written, the Abhidharma Kosha was written in 350 AD, and you don't have to look at the reading, because I mean, that's mostly for you to take home and digest after we finish today, okay? But we're going to start from the Abhidharma. Why? Because Abhidharma Kosha, which is like a big encyclopedia of Buddhism, in the fourth chapter, it gives the whole teaching on karma. If you want to know about karma, you got to go to the fourth chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha. And the opening lines are, Lele Jigden Natsoke, Deni Sabadande Che. So say, Lele Jigden Natsoke. Lele Jigden Natsoke. Okay, Le means karma, okay? It's the Tibetan word for karma. Le means work. Lega means, Nga lega yomare. Tari lega yomare means, I don't got any work to do today. Okay, Le means doing something. Lele Jigden Natsoke. Jigden means, in Sanskrit, loka. Loka means the world. Okay, it can either mean the outside world or it can mean the people who live in the world. And in Buddhism, they say the pot and the things in the pot. So the pot is the world, and the things in the pot is you and me. So that's Jigden. That's the world. Natsoke means that's where they all come from. That's where all these different planets and universes and galaxies and all these trillions of kinds of different creatures, that's where they all come from. Because the third chapter of the Abhidharma is this huge presentation of all the planets in the universe and the galaxies. It talks about time and space. It's very beautiful. It explains time down to milliseconds, and then it goes up to galaxies, you know, light years. It explains where the worlds come from. It explains how they are destroyed. Like, our world is going to be destroyed by a supernova of our sun. And it describes the whole process. It's very interesting. Then at the very end it says, and don't think all these things were made by some creator. They weren't put here by some being who was, didn't have any lei that day, so he was making worlds, you know. Because the opening lines of the fourth chapter say, if you want to know where all these universes came from, all these galaxies, all these planets, you know, if you want to know where the trees in Raleigh, North Carolina came from and things like that, it says, Lele Natsu, Jigden Natsuke. Lei means your own karma. Okay, they come from your own karma. If a group of you are experiencing a room called the Kadampa Center together, then you have a communal karma. You all collected some kind. We all met before. We all did something before. And as a result, we're all experiencing this room together. Lele Jigden Natsuke. So there are many kinds of karma. The next line says, Deni Semba Dandeche. Say, Deni Semba Dang Deche. Deni Semba Dang Deche. Okay. Tibetan, do you know Sem? Sem means mind. The word Sem in Tibetan, Chitta, means mind. But this text says Deni Semba. Sempa and Sem are not the same thing. Sem means mind. Semba is something else. And people have struggled for years to figure out an English word for it, you know. And I've heard a lot of strange ones, you know. Like, mentation was popular for a while. But I've never seen mentation in the New York Times or any place. And I didn't know what it was for, you know. And it's important to know what Semba is, because Deni Semba Dandeche, the essence of karma, is Sempa, okay. Deni Semba Dangdeche. That's the definition of karma. In the second line of the chapter on karma, you know, Deni Semba. So Semba is the essence of karma. What is Semba? You know, you need to know what Semba is. And it's very difficult, but what it means is anytime your mind moves. Okay, it's the movement of the mind. It's every infinitesimally small shifting of your mind. It's when your mind shifts from one object to another, when you think of anything. Anytime you're in Tibetan, they call kukyogyat. Kukyogyat means this, watch. And that's a kukyogyat. Kukyogyat means, you know, just when you have a very lazy person, you say, ko kyuni kukyogyat mintu, which means, you know, he never even twitches. But, so kukyo just means a twitch, you know, a twitch of the body. But a twitch of the mind means anytime the mind goes from here to here, you know, just the slightest thing like that, the mind goes to a new object, the mind shifts just a touch. That's a semba. How many sembas occur in a minute? They say in this moment, I believe it's something like, it's many thousand, I don't remember the number, but it's in the snap of a finger, it's called Jaga Kechik Matama. I think there's 64 in a finger snap. In a finger snap, you have 64 sempas going on. Okay, I mean, your mind is shifting or it's like a jet, you know. It's moving in time, 64 times in the time that it takes me to snap my fingers. And during that time, depending on your motivation, you have just collected 64 separate karmas. Okay, you've just had, okay. I mean, you've had that many sembas, all right. That's a lot. Okay, that's karma. Karma means work or doing something. So your mind has done something. Like many times in a single moment, in a single minute, in an hour, your mind has collected thousands of karmas, thousands and thousands of karmas. That's the nature of karma. Dani samba dang say dang de che. Say loud dang de che. Dang de che. Dang de che means and what it produces, which means Dani lu dang agile. Next line. Dani lu dang agile means, what does the mind produce? Well, it produces the other two kinds of karma. So what are the other two kinds of karma? Ngak, speech, and nu,
body.
Okay, so bodily or verbal karma. You know, something you say or something you do. So by now we have three kinds of karma. One is what? First one is semba, mental karma. Second one is verbal. And then the third one is physical, doing something with your body. So karma just means anytime you do something. It can be physical. Classically, you hurt somebody, or you kill, or you steal something. For example, bad karma. Verbal, you know, you say something bad about someone. You try to split people up with something you say. Bad karma. Or mental. You crave something that somebody else has. You wish that somebody else would fail, for example. Those are the three kinds of karma. Those are the three ways you can express karma. And then supposedly, oh, by the way, how do you decide if a karma is good or bad? I mean, what's the definition of a good karma and a bad karma? Do you know? Means, and it's very interesting, you see, this is how Buddhism defines morality itself, or ethical living itself. Bad karma is defined as any action you take, meaning thoughts as well, which lead to a sensation of suffering for you. Okay, that's very interesting. You know, bad karma is defined as anything that hurts you. Okay, that's very interesting. You know, I mean, the definition of what, you know, if I want to decide whether or not something I did was bad or good, bad karma is defined as something that, after it goes through that cooking process, which is called number mimba, it will come back and make me suffer. And that's the definition of bad karma. That's very interesting. You know, there's three other choices, right? One is that there's this being watching, and he doesn't like it. And it's not that. And the second is that even that it hurts other people, which is partly part of the definition also, but that's not the main thing either. It's the definition of bad karma is a karma, something you do that after a process of ripening will come back and hurt you, will make you suffer. So that's the definition of bad karma. Definition of good karma is what? Yeah. Any action, thought or action which after a cooking process called pachiti in Sanskrit, after a time of ripening or cooking, or it sits somewhere and it cooks for a while and then it comes back to you, that's bad karma. That's a bad karma. So those are all the meanings of karma. So you're collecting in one moment, you say 64 karmas. Well, when do they have time to come back to you? You know, that's a lot. It's going to be a couple thousand in a few minutes. You know? Where do they all stay? Where do they go in the meantime? I used to think of karma as this big cosmic boomerang, you know, and I yell at somebody at work and I'm throwing this boomerang, and then, you know, 6 months later, my boss is screaming at me for something I didn't do, and I can't figure out why. You know, I don't know where it came from. And I used to think that it must be out near Pluto somewhere, you know. You know, it must be, I don't know where that is. I don't know where that karma went to. But I did a bad thing at work. And then I was just sitting there minding my business one day, and the boss comes in and screams at me, you know. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't do anything today, you know. And, you know, and it doesn't seem to make sense, you know. Where does karma stay in the meantime, you know? Where did it go? And where did it stay? And how does it come back to me, you know? And those are all, I think if you study karma carefully, then you can accept karma much more easily. And if no one ever explains it to you, and it just seems to be like this belief that people have in Asia, that, oh, bad things that happened to them come from something bad they did. It sounds nice. It's a good way to keep people in line. But, you know, but kid, does it really make any sense? And why should I believe it any more than anything else? You know, the Bible says, why do the wicked prosper? This is a big question. You know, why do bad people get rich and have big houses and everything's going right for them? You know, and why do good people have these disasters? You know, why do little babies get cancer? You know, what did they do? You know, how could it happen? You know, and there's this, it's one of the great questions of Christianity, for example, you know, how given the Christian teaching, could it happen? How could it be like that? You know, what did they do? Or even if they did do something bad, you know, why is this happening to them? And they're too young, they didn't have time to do anything that bad, you know. And it's a big question, and Buddhism struggled with it also, you know. Buddhism has struggled with it all through the history of Buddhism, and all the different schools of Buddhism talk about it a little bit differently. So I'm going to go into some of those. And why are there four different schools of Buddhism? You know, why are there are four great early Indian schools of Buddhism? The first one you can call Abhidharma school. Those were the very most elementary school, and they're very, very great scholars, great Buddhists, and they talk about Buddhism in terms of Abhidharma. Abhidharma means higher knowledge, and you can call them the knowledge school. And they were the first great school of Buddhism. After that, there are the sutras, and they are, you can think of them as the logic school. They had a lot of faith in figuring things out with logic and using logic to figure out, for example, how do we perceive things, you know. Why when you look at a cow, do you think cow? What is it about a cow? Is there some kind of cowness about a cow that makes you think cow when you look at a cow? Or what is it about a Ford that when you look at a Ford car, you see a car, you know? What is it that makes you see a car? You know, why don't you see, I mean, if a bug looks at a Ford, he doesn't see a car. He sees something else, you know. He's got a whole different experience of that object. You know, what is it about me that makes me see car? And what is it about bug that makes him see an insurmountable mountain? You know, what is it? What's in my brain that makes me see that? That's the whole emphasis of the second school. And then the third school is a mind-only school called Tsimtsampa. They're struggling. One of the big questions they're struggling with is, where does karma stay? You know, where do you put karma in the meantime? And then the higher, the fourth school is the Madhyamika school, middle way school, mostly concerning themselves with emptiness. And what? Why did the Buddha teach four different schools? By the way, there many of their ideas are contradictory. You know, many of the ideas in the first school are proved wrong by the time you get to the third school. In the monastery, we have to study them for 18 years. We spend 12 years in the first school. We spend 2 years each in the other three schools. And it's always confusing because your teacher will teach you the first school, and you go and you debate it and you learn it and you memorize it and everything. And then by the time you get to the second school, they tell you everything was wrong. And they say, put on the new hat. They say, you have to take off that Abhidharma hat, and now you have to put on the logician hat, you know, and you're getting confused, and you say to the teacher, you know, why did the Buddha teach four different schools? And a lot of the ideas of the lower schools are wrong. Well, what's the point, you know? And then it ends up that it's all very useful. There's nothing in the lower schools that's not very useful. And different people at different points in their spiritual lives need different explanations. You know, we're not all ready for the highest explanation at the beginning. I mean, it would blow your mind. It would make you crazy. Literally. And so, start with the Abhidharma school, work up, you know, understand. And some people maybe will never be ready for the second school in this life. So the first, you know, teaching them the first school helps them and brings them up slowly, which is the idea. You have to do it that way. But since we're so advanced, we're going to skip right to the Tsimtsampa. Say Tsimtsam. Tsimtsam. You had Sim already. Sim was mind. Okay. And Sam means what?
Merely.
Yeah, only. Okay, only mind. Merely mind. Okay. Tsimtsam. Chittamatra in Sanskrit. But this is a school that's, you know, widely misunderstood. The name of the school is mind only. And the Buddha did teach in certain sutras that things are mind only. Okay? And then, you know, when this word got to our country, these poor Tsimtsampas, they got misunderstood. And people said, oh, everything is only the mind, you know. So Tsimtsam is the mind-only school. And they have a really nice explanation of how karma is stored. Where does karma stay? How is karma planted? And how does it affect you later? Supposedly, according to Buddhism, karma stays, the power of karma stays for up to millions of years. There's three kinds of karma. One is called tonggyurkile. Say tonggyur.
Tonggyur.
Tonggyur means you can see it. And the implication is that before you die, you see the result of something you did in this life. Okay? And that's a special kind of karma. And then the other two are ones that you see in the next life, in the very next life. And then the results which you see in the second life and beyond. Okay, so theoretically, it could take millions of years for a karma to come back to you. Okay. By the way, there's a beautiful book by Dharmakirti. He lived in maybe around 700 AD that explains why future lives should exist, you know, and I think it's very useful for people like you and me who grew up in this country, because in this country there's an assumption that you don't live in a future life. I mean, you grow up, your parents tell you from when you're a little kid, nobody talks about future lives. Nobody, when you're a kid and you kill a fly on the window screen, you know, your parents don't say, oh, you're in big trouble in your future life, you know. It's just something that's totally absent from our culture. You know, I never got told that. Nobody here got told that. And it's just, you just believe it. In the depths of your heart, because you grew up in America, you don't think about future lives. And when someone starts talking about them, you know, as a Buddhist, you can sort of think probably they exist, but you don't have much proof for it. you don't understand why. And then if you're an Asian and you grew up in Asia and your parents did yell at you and said you're going to be a fly in your future life, and so you believe in future lives, but you don't know why either. You know, we don't believe in them and we don't know why. And they do and they usually don't know why. And Dharmakirti wrote a wonderful book about it. It's in the Pramanabhartika. And there's a whole section there where he explains clearly why you and I can accept a future life and a past life. And I don't have time today. It takes about a week. But at the end of a week, I think most people most normal American thinking people would say, okay, yeah, I will have a future life. I now I understand that. You know, and you don't need to be, you don't have to have some, you know, higher plane realization or something to accept it. You can just accept it from a good, normal presentation of Dharmakirti's thinking. There's not many Buddhist books that prove the existence of future and past lives, because none of the audience was interested, because they all thought they already existed. Often they didn't know why, you know. And Dharmakirti himself says that. So, but anyway, the Semtams are saying, if it takes millions of years, perhaps, for a karma to ripen, well, where does that karma stay? You know, and that was another misconception I used to have when I was a kid. People would say, oh, that's your karma. And karma would mean, I don't know what it means. I think in that case it means more the result than the cause. Karma means the cause. Karma is what you did. Yeah, or bad luck. Bad luck, that's your karma. Fate, something like fate. Karma is the action that you do. You know, kam karo in India. What are you doing nowadays? What are you up to? Karma means the action that you did that causes the result. The result is not called karma. The consequence, I like to call it consequence. The consequence is something else. So you have a cause, something you did, and then you have a consequence, and then somewhere in between there has to be a connector. There has to be something between the cause, meaning, you know, you yelled at somebody at work, and the result, which might come a million years from now, and where does the karma stay in the meantime, you know? Or what is it that stays in between? We call a seed. It's called a seed. In Tibetan, it's a nice... People like this word. Say bakchat.
Bakchat.
Sounds neat, right? Bakchat.
Bakchat.
Bakchat. Bakchat means a mental seed. It's a seed. In Buddhism, anything that changes has to be of three different kinds. It can either be physical, like your body. It can be mental, like your mind. But there's a third category, which are called demanducci. Demanducci means something that's not physical or mental, but it's changing. Okay. Bakchak is one of those. Bakchak is an energy. Okay. It is not the mind, and it's not mental. It's also not physical. It's not like when you do a karma, somebody injects this little thing into your bloodstream. And it's also karma, the seed for the karma, where the karma stays, is also not mental. It's in the mind, but it's not of the mind. It's something that's residing in the stream of the mind. Okay, and that's a bhakchak. Okay, so it's not a boomerang going to Pluto. Okay, it's a bhakchak. It's a kind of energy. What is the nature of that energy? You know, where does it stay? There's a big argument about it. The mind-only school has one idea, other schools have other ideas. And they're in the reading. If you're bored some night, you can read them all. And they're difficult. And this is a very great scholar, Jetsun Kapa. The first reading is by Jetsun Kapa, most of it. You know, his sentences are about 12 miles long, and his thoughts were longer than that. And it's difficult reading. But basically, he's trying to show what the mind-only school thought, where they thought karma stayed in the meantime. Okay, you yell at somebody at work. 6 months later, your boss is yelling at you. You have no idea why. You know, where was the karma staying in the meantime? And how does it ripen? How does it come out? How does it flower? You know, why is the question important? Because supposedly, every single experience you're having in your whole life is a result of karma. Okay? The color of this pillar, you know, your own awareness of your own mind, the shape of your body, whether you get a raise at work this year or not, you know, the very shape of the planet, the question of whether the sun's going to come up in the morning or not, the condition of a tiny hair on the edge of your ear, they are all coming from the same source. It's karma. It's your karma. Every single detail of your life is being determined by karma. And even the karma it takes for me to move my hand, you know, the karma it takes for me to be able to do that is tremendous. You know, if you know computers, you can think about it in terms of bytes, you know. Like, they can't make good animation on a computer yet because it takes so many little dots to make the hand go smoothly across the screen. It would take, you know, we did a 10-minute section of my lama doing a mandala offering, you know, for a computer thing, and it took 50 megabytes, you know. It was like, you know, that 1-minute section of having it go smooth requires 50 million dots of information. And karma is exactly the same thing. The karma it takes for me to move my hand like that, you know, all the individual karmas that have to flow and flower and ripen at the same moment in my mind and in your mind, if you can see my hand, are incredibly fantastic. They're almost infinite. The amount of the energy of karma that has to go into a single motion of somebody's hand is almost infinite. There are huge forces going on that maintain your world. You know, there are incredibly complex and numerous trillions and trillions of karmas are going off in a few minutes for you to maintain your world. You know, for the whole world that you're experiencing to go on, it's requiring jillions of bites of karma. And that's exactly what's happening. They are ripening in your mind at the rate of trillions per hour. And you are having this smooth experience of a life. And your own body and your own mind. Everything is a ripening of your past deeds, of your past karmas. And for all of us to see the sun go up in the morning is a big event. It's a big communal cooperative effort. You know? All of us have to have had the same karma. We gave someone warmth. You know, we provided light for someone. And we, even such a natural thing as the sun coming up in the morning, is a ripening of, if it's pleasant for you, of a what kind of karma? Of a good karma. Okay, I mean, the sun is a tremendous good karma. Is a result of a tremendous good karma. If it's pleasant to you, you know, if you have a sunburn and the sun's coming up, it's not a pleasant karma anymore. It's the result of your bad karma. Same thing, same object. You know, but for you, it's a result of an unpleasant karma. So, and by the way, how long does it take for a karma like your life to end? I mean, does it peter out or what?
I don't know.
No, you just die. You have a car accident. And you have a car accident, your head hits the windshield, and in that 1 second, this ripening of millions of karmas changes radically. And you're not a human being anymore. You know, that those trillions of karmas that we're maintaining, it's like a... You see those water geysers holding up a ball, you know? And that's your karma. And the minute the water cuts off, the ball falls down. And you're not having any of the experiences you used to have. You know, you don't have any... You no longer at that moment have any karma to be anything human at all. You know, there's no reason to assume that you'll be anything like what you were 10 minutes before that. Because those ripenings suddenly ran out, you know, just ran out of energy. Somebody unplugged the computer, you know, And you will have radically different experiences. You will go from thinking you're pretty healthy and your life is going pretty well and your family's doing nice and you got this house and everything. You'll go from that to zero. Your intellect also. You will not even have the mind that you have now. I mean, it's to be intelligent or to be reasonable or to be happy or to be reason. All these things are karmas ripening. And when the karmas run out, you won't even have a mind. You won't remember your name. You know, you won't remember anything about what you were. Because the cause for even the karmas for that mind to exist also finished. And you'll just be a radically different being. So it's no big mystery. You know, if you explain it in terms of karma, a sudden shift in your karma, and then you're not anything what you used to be. You assume that you're going to be like you are today, tomorrow. This and you can't say that. When the karmas run out, which could be this afternoon, you'll be at zero. You go back to zero. You might as well be an insect. You know, you can't even guarantee you'll be as good as an insect. You know, because the karmas that kept you, that kept supporting you, are finished. You know, so how does that work? You know, I have to explain that, or else it just sounds a little crazy. Okay, we have to talk about bhakchaks. When you do a deed, when you do anything. Let's say that you yell at someone, okay? You say something unpleasant to somebody. That's a bad deed number out of the 10? 6, right? Harsh words. Saying something hard to somebody. We have, you know, 10 classic bad deeds in Buddhism. That's number 6. You know, saying something unpleasant that hurts someone's feelings. Let's say you do that number 6. You yell at somebody. So, how is the karma collected? Okay, according to Semtsampa. If you're going to talk about creating planets, you go to Abhidharma. If you're going to talk about where does the karma stay, you go up to school number 3. And you talk about Semtsampa. They say that perceiving yourself doing the deed is very important. In other words, your perceptions as you yell at someone are very important. And what it refers mostly to is motivation. You know, and it refers to recognition of what you're doing. Okay, like I make a lot of jokes at work, and I've been informed by people that it hurts people. But I didn't have any, you know, I was just trying to be a good guy. You know, I was just trying to be friendly at work, and I make a joke about somebody, and you know, a week later somebody tells me they really got upset that I said something that was not funny to them. Is that a harsh word, you know? Is that breaking the 6th non-virtue? Is that a bad deed? A lot of it depends on your motivation, okay? It's very important at the moment for a good bhakchak to be planted. You have to be conscious of what you're doing. It's called leki lam. Le and leki lam are different things. Le means karma. Leki lam means a path of karma. Path of karma means a complete karmic action, as opposed to just doing something. And leki lam is different from a le. Le, you've got all these sembas going on in your mind. You've got all these, your mind is moving and twitching all the time. But a leki lam is one whole, well-cooked deed that you did. And there have to be certain elements there, okay, for you to have a karma, to really collect a good karma. First of all, you have to have the motivation. You know, you have to want to hurt somebody. You know, you have to have in mind hurting somebody. It's very important also to have some kind of premeditation. You know, you have to walk in the room and say, I'm about to say this thing to this person, and I'll be quite happy if they're upset, you know. You know, there has to be some kind of it's called shi sampa jo tatu. Shi sampa means you have to have some kind of intention there. Then you actually have to undertake the deed. Sometimes you think to do something and then you don't get a chance to do it. Do you collect any karma? Like you want to say something bad to somebody, you burst into the room and they're not there. You know? You do collect karma, okay? You collect what we call sampa. You know, you've had some premeditation. But you don't have jorwa. Jorwa means you actually undertake the thing. You do collect karma, but you don't collect a full, cooked, powerful karma if you don't have the actual, what do you call it, consummation of the deed, where you're actually, you know, able to do the thing. She sampa. She means you should recognize the person for who they are. You know, if I burst into the room and the lights are out, and I say, "You're an idiot, Jack," and it turns out somebody else is in the room and Jack's not there, do I collect the deed of do I collect the karma of undertaking the harsh words? I do. But the she is not there. She means the object that I meant to do it to should be there. There should be some kind of recognition, you know. It's like stabbing a lump on a, going into a room at night and stabbing the person in their bed, and you find out it's just, you don't have the object of the killing. By the way, in that case, you also don't have tartuk. Tartuk is, if you're intending to kill somebody, that the person should what? Should die, you know. Like if you wound them and they never die, you don't collect the karma of killing. Okay, so all those things have to be there for karma to be there. But the main thing is, you have to know what you're doing, and you have to see yourself doing it. You have to be conscious of yourself doing it. You have to know what you're doing, and you have to see it. You have to be aware of it. And that's a very important about the creation of a bhakchak. How does karma get planted? There has to be a perception. You have to see yourself doing it. Okay? There has to be. That's why insanity really is a good defense in Buddhism also. You know? It really is. If you're totally crazy and you have no right mind about what you're doing, you do collect some bad karma. But it's not as powerful as if, you know, the kind of dirty deed I'm talking about, where, you know, you're angry, you're going to say something to somebody, you get the person in a corner, you know who they are, the lights are on, you know it's them, you say exactly what you meant to say, and you get the reaction that you wanted when their face falls, and they get hurt. And then you've done a real deed. But what's important, paramount thing there is that you are doing the action, and you are watching yourself do the action. Being aware that you're doing it, watching yourself doing it, plants a bhakchak. Okay, where does it plant it?
In the mind stream.
Okay, in the mind stream. There's a lot of arguments in Buddhism, you can read them in there, about where do they get planted. All right. If they get planted in the mind stream, there's a lot of arguments about that. Buddhism loves arguments, but it helps you clarify things also. If you say mind stream, okay, this is a debating in Buddhism. Okay, are you telling me it's planted in the mind stream? And the guy says, duh, say duh.
Duh.
By the way, duh doesn't mean duh, okay? Duh in Buddhist debate means, that's right, that's what I said. And you gotta have chutzpah, you know. You gotta, duh. Say duh.
Duh.
Okay. And then I say, Tola me'atau. Okay, tola me'atau means, are you telling me no one could perceive emptiness directly? Then you say, teacher. Okay, say teacher.
Teacher.
Teacher means, what the hell are you talking about? What's it got to, you know, what's it got to do with what I, all I said was it was planted in the mind, and then you're saying, you're telling me nobody could perceive emptiness. And that's how the chess game starts in a Buddhist debate, you know. So somehow I have to tie you up. I'm going to checkmate you about three arguments down, okay? And we already started. You already checkmated. Okay, so I say... No, it's fun, no. So I say, I think no one ever perceives emptiness directly because at that moment, they still have bad thoughts in their mind, okay? They still have bad... At that moment of the direct perception of emptiness, they still have impure items in their mind. Yimbata. You say... You can say... If you say ta madu... Okay, say ta...
Ta.
Madu.
Madu.
Ta madu.
Ta madu.
Ta madu means... Of course they don't. Okay. Or do they? What do you say?
Actually, of course they don't, or they wouldn't be able to perceive emptiness directly.
Okay, good. Okay, so at the moment of perceiving emptiness directly, there's nothing impure in their minds, right? So legi bhata marata. So a person who perceives emptiness at that moment doesn't have these bhakchaks in their mind, trillions of bhakchaks just waiting to pop up like tulips in the spring in Raleigh, North Carolina, you know? Right? Nimbadha. Okay, say duh.
Duh.
So then if you say duh, then where do they go? Bhakcha marata. So they just, there's no more. If the stream of the mind is the carrier for the bhakchak, and if the stream of the mind at one moment in its history becomes totally purified, which is true at the path of seeing, the direct perception of emptiness, then does that person destroy all his karmic seeds?
I would think so.
Yeah, right. Okay. So then he becomes a totally enlightened Buddha upon the occasion of first seeing emptiness directly.
But then he can accumulate more karma on top of that, correct?
Oh, later.
I mean, instantly, the next instant, he could be...
When he comes out of that experience,
right.
Say. But that's not the case. You know, there is a fourth... After the direct perception of seeing, you go on for a long time before you become a Buddha or before you reach nirvana. Typical is 7 lifetimes. It's very typical. 7 more lifetimes before you are able to use that perception to clear out your mind stream. So you can't say those karmas do live there, and the person for the next 7 lives undergoes the results of those karmas. So they are there. They're with him or her, but they are not in the mind. You're right. Okay, you actually won that part.
Yeah.
Okay, they do stay in the person, but they don't. That's why the higher school says they don't stay in the mind stream. They stay in with the person, but they don't stay in the mind stream. So somehow they stay with the personality of the person, the persona, but they don't stay in the mind stream because the mind stream at that point has to be totally purified of those things. So that's the argument. That's one of the arguments. But what happens is, by the way, is a bhakchak a changing thing, Mr. Hackett? Does a bhakchak, is a bhakchak a changing thing?
Is a bhakchak an impermanent phenomenon?
Yeah. I'll give you a clue, okay?
So you said it's an
adutra? Well, I'll give you a clue, because sooner or later it has to produce a result.
Right.
It has to do something. And in Buddhism, anything that does something has to be changing. Changing. Changing means as it produces its consequence, as the bhakchak gives you some boss yelling at you, you know, as it ripens, it has to change. Like any seed, you know, like a tulip bulb as it sends out a sprout has to change. And it normally it destroys itself by giving its result. Hopefully, right? In the case of bad karma. So a bhakchak has to be impermanent. It has to be changing from instant to instant, okay? Then how can it stay for millions of years? You know, how can karma be stored even for 10 minutes? The deed is finished. You know, the deed is gone. You yelled at somebody at work, you know, hours ago. So where's the karma? You know, where's the bhakchak? Sorry, the karma's finished, right? The karma, which means that original deed of yelling at somebody, is finished. The bhakchak is staying with the persona, okay? You can say mind stream. Higher school says, say mind stream, it's okay. You know, it's staying in your mind, okay? But how can it stay for a million years? You know, is it changing or not? According to Buddhism, if it's going to give a result eventually, it has to be changing from instant to instant. So how does it stay? How can it stay? No. And Buddhism says... it's pretty interesting. It's like this billiard ball effect. And it's true that a bhakchak and everything else in the world, including us, is changing from moment to moment. And that we are santani. We're a stream of events. But as the bhakchak, as this bhakchak, moment of bhakchak ends, it leaves some of it, imparts its energy to the next bhakchak. So it replicates itself. So that's how bhakchaks go on. Karma can stay in your mind stream, we'll say, for a long time. Because as each instant passes, the Bhak Chakra, the first instant, imparts its energy to the Bhak Chakra, the second instant. It's like a long string of billiard balls. And when you hit the first one, it goes tick, 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 and the last one moves, you know. So it's possible. And the perception, watching yourself do a good or bad thing, started it. That energy, this is the karma of yelling at somebody. And that imparts the original energy. That's the stick. That's the billiard cue, you know, the pool cue. That's the action. The very first action you do, yelling at somebody, sets in motion the first bhakcha. It imparts it's gone. That karma is finished. The minute you finish yelling and your lips close and there's silence and the guy's going, you know, like that, the karma is already done. Like, the karma is actually finished. But it has just imparted energy to a bhakcha. And that energy has begun. And that energy will replicate itself until
hell freezes over?
It doesn't. Until the consequence comes out. Until you get the result. You know, that's one good thing about suffering, is that you're using up bad karma. This energy will be replicated until the moment that you experience the result. You know, it will replicate itself until the moment that you experience the result. Okay, where do these little bok choks stay? I mean, that's a lot of bok choks. They're going to be a big place to stay. The Sensam school says it's got to stay in a thing called kunshi.
Say kunshi.
Kunshi. Kunshi is alaya vijnana, kunshi nambashepa. It means, kun means everything, all, and shi means basis. And sometimes they translate it as storehouse consciousness, sometimes they call it basis consciousness or things like that. But the mind-only school says there's gotta be this big consciousness where all these bok choks hang out until the consequence comes back to you. There's gotta be some place where they stay. So they came up with this thing called kunshi. And that's a big part of your mind where the bok choks are staying until the day that they come back to you. Okay. And the way that they come back to you is very extraordinary, and it has to do with kunshi. You know, if you want to know how karma comes back to you, what is it that's making you see this world right now? Why do you see the sun come up in the morning? Which, by the way, don't assume that it's always going to be that way. Things can change as soon as the karma changes. It has a lot to do with kunshi. You have to understand how kunshi works. So kunshi is that. What is kunshi? Do you remember? Which is woo? What's that? It took me like 3 years to learn that word. What's a kunshi? You can call it storehouse consciousness. You know, it's the place where all those bok choks are hanging out until they flower. Now, how do they flower? The mind-only school says they flower in the following way. Let's say that you screamed at somebody 6 months before at work, and then your boss comes to you and yells at you. When that boss is standing there with a red face and saying something very unpleasant to you, that is the old bok chak, the old karma's seed, which is ripening in the
mind stream.
In the kunshi, okay? It's ripening in that consciousness. And so what you're really seeing, you are observing a karmic seed ripening within a part of your own mind. And there is no boss outside yelling at you. You're actually observing, you know, a miniature little bhakcha ripening in your own mind. And you mistake that for an external object, but you're just watching your own mind giving an apparition that's based on that bhakcha that went ding 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 ding, and then finally flowered as an appearance of something. And they say that makes good sense. There's a very close correlation between you seeing yourself hurting someone and then much later seeing yourself being hurt by someone else. Those are actually very, very compatible. If you think about it, the nature of yelling at someone is unpleasant, red in the face, loud noise. And the nature of getting yelled at is unpleasant, red in the face, loud noise, somebody getting hurt. So I say that's very compatible. That makes a lot of sense. You know, that It's very, very interesting. So think of it as a psychological event. Think of it as karma being collected when you see yourself doing something bad. And then it's being stored in your mind as an energy which, when it flowers and when it ripens, forces you to have a very similar perception. And whether or not it's inside your mind or outside your mind, I mean, the Madhyamika says, who cares? You know, I mean, they get to a point where they say, you don't need to explain it with kunshi. You don't need to say it's external or internal. It happens to be mostly external. But that's not the point. The point is that, you know, when we got to this point in the monastery, I remember I was sitting at my teacher's, the foot of his bed. He used to teach on top of his bed. And in Tibet, you do not interrupt the Lama. You know, in the monasteries, you never, ever interrupt the Lama. You know, and I said, it sounds great to me. I said, can I ask you a question? He said, like, yeah, okay. And I said, this explanation sounds really good to me. You know, you perceive yourself doing something bad. It plants a seed in your mind. That seed replicates itself over a period of time. And when the proper causes are ready, the seed ripens and you perceive yourself getting yelled at. It sounds great to me because now it makes sense to me. You know, it's a perception. It's created by a perception. The result of the perception is this seed that replicates itself. And then at the end you have a corresponding perception of being yelled at. And I said, it just sounds great to me. You know, what's wrong with it, right? We're in third school, right? We're not in fourth school. We're not in Madhyamika school. We're in mind-only school. I said, what's wrong with it? I don't see... Because it was a burning personal question. I wanted to know. You know, I want to know about karma. I want to be able to stop it. So what's wrong with this? And he says, it's perfect. He says, Madhyamika accepts it. They don't accept that you need a separate part of your mind to store the bhakchaks. But all that other stuff is fine. They accept it. It's perfect. And I was so happy. You know, I'm like, oh, great. You know, so that's how karma works. I mean, you have a... It's very, very dependent on what perceptions you're having as you do it. That's why you can do a wrong thing with the right motivation. And the example in the Abhidharma is killing your parents out of mercy. You know, they're very ill and you. The example in the Abhidharma, generally speaking, killing your parents is one of the five deeds that must take you to the lowest hell immediately after you die. But then the Abhidharma says, what if you do it with the wrong belief that it's somehow putting them out of their misery? Why is it wrong?
You don't know where... Well, you don't know where they're going to be reborn.
Well, 99.99999% of all human beings are born in hell directly afterwards. So, if you are supposedly, okay. So you're not doing anybody a favor, you know? I mean, no, we'll talk more about it. We'll talk more about it. But you're not doing anybody a favor, you know? I mean, it's just, if you understand Abhidharma, you read Buddhist scripture, you know that you're not putting anybody out of any misery. Misery in the human realm is nothing compared. They say that being stabbed with a 10,000 spears over the course of a whole lifetime in the human realm wouldn't equal a second of the pain in the hell. So you're not helping anybody. That's just a general comment, okay? But anyway... But the motivation at that moment is very good. It's called white, karpa le karpa. So it's white motivation. And your motivation is very good. Your perception at the moment of turning off your mother's respirator or something is that I'm helping this person, you know. I'm putting this person out of their misery. Therefore, you don't collect. You don't have the perception of killing your mother wantonly. And therefore, you don't collect the same karma. It's not the same thing because of your motivation. And again, the perception is very much tied up to how the bhakchak is planted. The bhakchak is largely planted by your perceptions. So we went to my teacher in the monastery. I took one of my students last year, and he got him in the corner, and he says, "What about Hitler?" You know, he says, "Hitler had the best motivations. You know, he was going to make the human race pure." You know, he truly thought he was making the human race pure. His motivation was perhaps extraordinary. You know, he was thinking that he will clean up the human race and make it really nice. And maybe even his his motivation was even more cosmic or more widespread than any of us. He really was thinking in terms of the whole civilization should become pure, which we rarely do. We're mostly worried about ourselves. So what about that, he said, you know. And that's where... And the teacher didn't even hesitate. He said, yeah, from a motivational point of view, if that was his motivation, then that motivation might even have a beneficial result for him. But the deed of killing so many people is obviously also planted a heavy bok chang. But the main thing is the motivation. The main thing is what you're intending, and that's what plants the karma in your mind.
Session 1 continues on the next CD.